Imagine discovering this highly advanced, like, custom-fit garage door opener just hidden deep inside a virgin, untouched forest.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That would be completely bizarre.
Right, like, you would instantly know, without a doubt, that a garage must exist somewhere nearby.
Yeah, of course.
Because, I mean, evolution is incredibly efficient. It doesn't just build these complex biological locks for keys that just, don't exist.
No, it definitely doesn't.
And that is the exact biological paradox we're exploring in our deep dive
Yeah.
today. We are pulling all of this from an absolutely fascinating article in the OOTW Journal titled The Body's Own Cannabis, The Endocannabinoid System.
It is such a good piece.
It really is. So if you're listening to this as someone who wants to understand your own biology, the learner out there who loves a good scientific mystery, the premise they present is kind of going to blow your mind.
Yeah, it's wild.
Because long before humans ever discovered or cultivated the cannabis plant, evolution had already built this native, like, inner cannabis system right inside our heads.
Yeah, and the timeline of discovery here is what makes it so compelling, honestly.
Yeah.
Because we are talking about a massive homemade network of calm and regulation,
Right.
and it's hardwired into our neurobiology, but it went completely unnoticed for like most of modern medical history.
Which is crazy to think about.
It is. I mean, it is arguably one of the most important physiological systems involved in establishing and maintaining human health. Yet we just stumbled onto it entirely backward.
Okay, let's unpack this because it really starts in 1964.
Right.
There was a researcher named Raphael Mishulam in Israel, and he successfully isolated THC, which is, the main active ingredient in the cannabis plant.
Yes, the big one.
Right, the big one.
Yeah.
And by mapping out that molecule, scientists eventually realized it was binding to specific receptors in the human brain.
Yeah.
But again, like the forest analogy, you don't evolve a receptor to process a random foreign flowering plant.
Exactly. The brain had to be making its own version of this molecule.
Right.
That plant lock, it was like this flashing neon sign for
Oh,
neuroscientists.
for sure.
If the human brain is studded with receptors perfectly shaped for THC,
Right.
well, the human body absolutely must manufacture a native key.
It just has to.
It has to. The problem was finding it actually took nearly 3 decades.
Wow. 30 years of just looking for the key.
Yeah, it wasn't until 1990 that Lisa Mitsuda and her team at the National Institute of Mental Health finally cloned that lock.
Okay.
The cannabinoid receptor type 1, or CB1,
TB1, right.
and the localization of this receptor, I mean, it shocked the neuroscience community.
Because it wasn't just in one little spot.
No, not at all. It wasn't some niche receptor tucked away in a dusty corner of the brainstem. It was one of the most abundant receptors in the entire central nervous system.
Yeah, and the OOTW Journal actually lists the specific areas it blanketed, and it reads like a map of our core human functions.
It really does.
They found CB1 receptors heavily concentrated in the cortex, the hippocampus,
Yep.
the basal ganglia, and the cerebellum, which, for anyone needing a quick anatomy refresher, means this lock is sitting directly on the control centers for our higher thought, our memory encoding.
Memory is a big one.
Huge. And our habit formation and our physical coordination.
Exactly. And the article notes that CB1 is a G protein coupled receptor.
Which means what exactly?
Well, to translate that out of textbook jargon, it means this receptor isn't just like a simple gate that pops open to let chemicals in.
Okay.
When a molecule binds to the outside of a G protein coupled receptor, it triggers this massive cascade of chemical signals on the inside of the cell.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it acts like a relay baton, fundamentally changing the internal behavior of the neuron itself.
Wow. So a system this massive, distributed across all those critical brain regions
Right.
and deeply conserved across species, I mean, that indicated it was structurally essential for basic survival.
Oh, absolutely.
Which brings us to the moment they finally found the garage to match the remote control.
Yes, the key.
The key. Just 2 years after Matsuda cloned the receptor, the key turned up.
Finally.
Yeah, in 1992, William Devane and Lumiere Hunnis, who were actually working in Raphael Mitchulam's lab,
Oh, full circle.
right, they isolated the body's native molecule. And what is just wild to me is that this key wasn't a standard protein or a peptide like most neurotransmitters,
No, it was a lipid.
a structural fat pulled right out of a pig brain that perfectly fit the CB1 lock.
Yeah, and identifying it as a lipid was a massive turning point.
Really? Why is that?
Well, it changes everything about how it functions, which we'll get into, but also because they recognize the profound sense of regulation and calm this molecule produced. They gave it a very intentional name.
Anandamide.
Anandamide, yeah, which is derived from the Sanskrit word ananda.
Which means bliss.
Exactly, bliss. And a few years later, researchers actually found a second, even more abundant native molecule called 2-AG.
Okay, so 2-AG and anandamide.
Right. Together, anandamide and 2-AG make up the body's primary endocannabinoids. They are the keys to the system.
Finding the key is, you know, a great biological victory. But reading through the source material, the thing that really stands out is that figuring out how this lipid key actually functioned.
Oh, man.
It required scientists to tear up the basic rules of neuroscience.
It literally had to rewrite the textbook.
Right. Because we look at how normal brain communication works. Classical neurotransmitters like dopamine or serotonin,
sure,
they are manufactured well in advance.
Yep, banked and ready to go.
Exactly. The brain packages them up and stores them in these little cellular bubbles called vesicles at the end of a neuron.
Right.
Basically keeping a stockpile of ammunition ready for whenever a signal needs to fire.
But the endocannabinoid system entirely rejects that stockpile model.
Which is so strange.
It is. Because anandamide and 2-AG are lipids, right? They're fats.
Yeah.
So they cannot be stored in water-based cellular bubbles.
Oh, good. Oil and water. They would just leak out.
Exactly. They would just slip right through the bubble's membrane. So the brain has to manufacture them on the spot.
On demand.
On demand. And the process is incredibly elegant. The neuron's outer membrane is literally made of a double layer of fats.
Okay.
When a neuron is triggered, special enzymes act like molecular scissors.
Right.
They instantly snip a tiny piece of that fatty membrane off, rapidly converting it into anandamide or 2-AG right in that exact millisecond.
That is just manufacturing on an unimaginably fast on-demand scale.
Yeah.
You are literally snipping a piece of your own brain structure to create a chemical messenger.
It's incredible.
But the timing of that manufacturing isn't even the most paradigm-shifting part of the article.
No, it's not.
It's the direction these molecules travel.
Right. So in 2001, researchers Rachel Wilson and Roger Nickel at UCSF documented a mechanic that essentially reversed the flow of traffic in the brain.
Wait, reversed it?
Yeah. In a standard synapse, neurons send messages strictly one way. From the sending neuron across the gap, to the receiving neuron.
Sender to receiver. Simple.
Right. The endocannabinoid system runs backward.
Backward. What's fascinating here is how this retrograde signaling functions as an emergency brake.
Oh, yeah.
Let's say a receiving neuron is being overstimulated.
Right.
It is flooded with calcium, which is the biological signal that it is firing too hard and too fast.
Okay, overwhelmed.
Exactly. In response to that calcium flood, the molecular scissors we just talked about instantly snip anandamide from the membrane.
Okay.
The receiving neuron then shoots that anandamide backward across the synaptic gap to land on the CB1 receptors of the sending neuron.
Wait, let me make sure I'm visualizing this right. So if normal brain communication is like someone aggressively shouting instructions through a megaphone at you.
Right.
The receiving neuron uses anandamide to basically reach across the room and turn down the volume knob on the megaphone itself.
The visual of reaching back to turn down the dial is the perfect way to conceptualize retrograde signaling.
That is so cool.
When anandamide binds to the CB1 receptor on the sender, it physically stops that sender from releasing any more excitatory neurotransmitters. It is a built-in feedback dimmer switch. It allows an overwhelmed neuron to actually dictate its own incoming inputs.
But if CB1 receptors are blanketing the entire brain, you know, why do we need a dimmer switch on basically every major circuit?
Good question.
Why is this backwards flow so critical? Mm. And the OTW Journal sums it up in one word.
Homeostasis.
Homeostasis, exactly. Balance.
Yep.
The absolute biggest threat to the nervous system isn't necessarily a specific disease. It's a lack of balance.
Right.
If a circuit has too much excitation, it runs too hot.
And running too hot in the brain leads to something called excitotoxic damage.
Which sounds bad.
It's very bad. To put it simply, it is like a car engine redlining without any coolant.
Ouch.
The neurons become so overstimulated by excitatory chemicals like glutamate that they literally fire themselves to death.
Oh my God.
Which is what happens during severe seizures or brain trauma.
Right.
Conversely, if you have too little excitation, the system goes entirely silent.
Also bad.
Very. The endocannabinoid system acts as the master regulator preventing both of those fatal extremes.
Right.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, You can see why this system's ubiquity explains so many real-world phenomena.
Yeah.
It isn't just one localized voice in the brain. It is the mixing engineer writing the faders of the entire nervous system, constantly tuning our pain, our appetite, our mood, our stress, and our temperature.
Which provides the biological explanation for phenomena that people have associated with cannabis for centuries.
Oh, absolutely.
For example, the text points out that CB1 receptors are heavily clustered in the hypothalamus.
Right, which is the brain's appetite control center.
Right, so when anandamide, or, you know, external THC, activates those specific receptors, it dramatically dials up hunger signals.
Yes.
It is the literal biological mechanism behind the munchies.
The actual science of the munchies.
Exactly. And the system isn't just confined to the brain either. The article highlights a second receptor, CB2, which sits primarily on our immune cells and acts as a dimmer switch for physical inflammation.
Which is huge for immune regulation.
Right. So what does this all mean?
Yeah.
If we have this vast interconnected network regulating everything from our immune response to our appetite and baseline mood,
right,
what happens if we try to artificially manipulate it?
That is where it gets tricky.
Yeah. The OTW Journal brings up a highly instructive and honestly chilling cautionary tale about pharmaceutical intervention.
Right. So pharmaceutical companies recognize the logic of the hypothalamus connection.
Okay.
They reasoned that if activating CB1 increases appetite, then chemically blocking the CB1 receptor should suppress appetite.
I mean, logically, that tracks.
It does. This led to the development of CB1 blocking drugs, most notably a drug called Rimonabant.
Rimonabant. Okay.
And it was designed as a revolutionary treatment for obesity.
Now, we should be clear that we are reporting strictly on the text findings here, taking a completely impartial look at the historical data. And according to the text, strictly from a weight loss perspective, blocking that receptor actually worked.
It did. People stopped overeating.
Right.
The metabolic results were significant.
Right.
However, the psychiatric results were disastrous.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The drug had to be entirely pulled from the market because patients developed severe, debilitating depression and intense anxiety, with some even experiencing suicidality.
That's horrible.
The failure of Rimonabant proved a vital biological reality. You simply cannot pull one single lever of this vast homeostasis system without moving all the others.
So you block the munchies, but because the receptor also regulates mood in the cortex and amygdala,
right,
you accidentally block the brain's ability to feel bliss.
Exactly.
The dimmer switch for joy was just jammed in the off position across the entire brain.
Yeah, it really highlights how delicately balanced this inner machinery is.
Absolutely. And that balance doesn't just manage, you know, daily appetite or a passing bad mood. This backwards flowing network is the fundamental mechanism the human body uses to survive intense physical stress and deep psychological trauma.
Yes.
Which brings us to a massive myth-busting section in the article.
Oh, I loved this part.
Me too. Because if you have ever gone for a grueling long-distance run and felt that wave of euphoric calm and pain relief wash over you.
The runner's high?
The runner's high, exactly. You probably credited endorphins.
Everyone credits endorphins.
Right. For decades, the runner's high was the exclusive domain of endorphins.
But the endorphin narrative was a very tidy, popular story in mainstream fitness, right?
Right.
But neuroscientists always knew it possessed a fatal biological flaw.
Ooh.
Yeah, endorphins are the body's natural opioids, but structurally, they are massive peptide chains.
Meaning they're physically large.
Yes, physically very large. Because they are so large, they do not easily cross the blood-brain barrier.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they essentially bounce off the brain's microscopic security checkpoint.
Okay.
So it never logically tracked how a surge of endorphins in the bloodstream could push into the brain to produce such a profound shift in conscious state and pain perception.
Oh, that makes so much sense. So the breakthrough on this came in 2015.
Yes.
A researcher named Johannes Fuss and his colleagues decided to rigorously test the endocannabinoid system's role in this phenomenon.
Right.
They put mice on running wheels and found that sustained running significantly spiked the mice's endocannabinoid levels.
Yep.
They observed the classic runner's high markers, right? A sharp reduction in anxiety and a massive increase in pain tolerance.
Classic signs.
But the brilliance of the Fuss study was how they proved which system was actually responsible. They use drugs to selectively block different receptors.
And this isolation of the variables is where the endorphin myth completely falls apart.
Okay, what's
when
right?
Fuss and his team chemically blocked the opioid receptors in the mice.
The endorphin ones.
Exactly, the exact receptors that endorphins use. The mice still experience the full runner's high.
Wait, really?
Yes. The pain relief and the calm state were completely unaffected.
The endorphins were essentially locked out, but the euphoria remained.
Right.
But when they blocked the cannabinoid receptors?
The runner's high vanished entirely.
Wow.
The pain tolerance plummeted back to baseline, and the anxiety relief disappeared.
That is wild.
The data confirmed that this blissful reward the body hands out for surviving sustained physical effort is driven by our inner cannabis system.
Right.
Specifically, anandamide crossing the blood-brain barrier with ease, not endorphins.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the endocannabinoid system doesn't just shield us from the physical stress of running.
No, it goes way deeper.
It is the primary biological shield against psychological terror.
Yes.
The article cites a pivotal 2002 study by Gioli Marsicano dealing with the mechanics of the amygdala and a process called fear extinction.
Right, and fear extinction is one of the most critical processes for mental survival.
How so?
It is the mechanism by which a learned threat is unlearned.
Okay.
So if an animal or a human repeatedly encounter something that used to be dangerous, like a specific sound or environment.
Like a loud noise or something.
Sure, but it repeatedly turns out to be safe. A healthy brain eventually updates its files.
It learns it's safe now.
Right. It lets the fear go so the organism isn't paralyzed by outdated threats.
So Marsicano looked at mice that were genetically altered so they completely lacked the CB1 receptor.
They had no lock.
Exactly. They were stripped of their inner cannabis lock. And what happened to them when exposed to trauma is profound.
It really is.
These mice were perfectly capable of learning to fear a tone that was paired with a mild shock.
Right. The amygdala encoded the memory of the trauma perfectly.
But when the researchers stopped the shocks and just played the tone safely over and over again, the mice lacking the CB1 receptor were utterly incapable of extinguishing that fear.
They couldn't let it go.
They stayed terrified of the safe tone indefinitely.
And that's because the retrograde signaling we discussed earlier is biologically required in the amygdala to quiet the fear circuit.
Oh, wow.
When the brain realizes a threat is gone, it uses endocannabinoids to turn down the megaphone of the trauma response, allowing new, safe learning to overwrite the old fear.
So if you don't have it.
Without that lipid molecule hitting that receptor, the brain stays frozen in a perpetual state of threat.
It functions as the brain's actual delete key for trauma.
Yes, beautifully put.
Without it, your brain just endlessly hoards terrifying files.
Right.
And when you understand that mechanism, you know, that the endocannabinoid system is the ultimate gatekeeper for fear extinction and neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense why this system naturally intersects with another massive trending topic covered in the OOTW journal.
Psychedelic therapy.
Exactly.
And the overlap is significant. But the text is incredibly careful to draw a strict biological distinction here.
Right. They're not the same thing.
Cannabis itself is not a classic psychedelic because they operate on entirely different hardware.
Different hardware. Okay.
Classic psychedelics like psilocybin or LSD primarily bind to the serotonin 2A receptor to promote plasticity.
Okay.
Cannabis, as we have established, acts strictly on the CB1 receptor.
However, because both the serotonin system and the endocannabinoid system deeply impact how we process fear, memory, and emotional regulation.
Right.
Combining them forces these two powerful networks to interact.
They overlap.
And the article stresses that this interaction requires immense caution. We are talking about two incredibly powerful biological levers that both touch the brain's vulnerability centers.
This raises an important question about how we interact with our neurobiology.
Yeah.
Because the endocannabinoid system sets our baseline capacity to let go of fear. Introducing a strong external cannabinoid like THC during a highly plastic psychedelic experience can either heavily intensify the session or entirely destabilize it.
Right. So if the brain's natural anandamide is like a microscopic scalpel, carefully tuning our fear response.
I like that.
Introducing external THC is like using a sledgehammer to tap a single piano key. Oh, man.
You might successfully hit the right note to relieve a specific anxiety, but you are also violently mashing the rest of the keyboard.
That's a great analogy. And the mechanics of THC explain why it is such a blunt tool.
Why is that?
Remember that native anandamide is manufactured on demand and destroyed by enzymes within minutes.
Right. It does its job and leaves.
It does its job and vanishes.
Right.
But THC is a very sturdy external molecule.
Oh, it sticks around.
When it binds to the CB1 receptor, it doesn't break down quickly. It just sits there, effectively jamming the dimmer switch in the down position for hours.
And because it jams that switch, heavy THC use carries real, documented side effects, which the text explicitly details.
Yes.
By keeping the dimmer switch pushed down in the hippocampus, THC physically blurs the formation of new memories.
Right.
The hippocampus simply cannot fire hard enough to encode short-term recall. And again, the text impartially notes that heavy use can worsen baseline anxiety over time, and it carries severe risks for adolescents whose brains are, you know, still actively building their neural architecture.
Very true.
It also poses significant risks for individuals with a genetic vulnerability to psychosis.
Yeah.
The authors make it exceptionally clear that analyzing the biology of this system is strictly educational. It is absolutely not a medical recommendation to use cannabis.
Right. The goal of the research is understanding the machinery we already possess, not blindly medicating it.
Exactly.
The beauty of the endocannabinoid system lies in its microscopic on-demand precision.
And as we wrap up this deep dive, I think that is the most powerful takeaway for the learner today.
I agree.
We are so conditioned to think of the human brain as a machine that fires strictly forward. You know,
right.
You experience a sensation, it travels forward into a thought, and that thought fires forward into an action.
Right. Line A to point B.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But underneath all of that forward momentum is this quiet, backwards flowing network. A network literally manufactured out of the brain's own structural fat, designed purely to act as a brake, keeping us from running too hot.
It's amazing.
It really is the biological definition of resilience.
It proves that the body has an intrinsic structural ability to find its way back to center, even in the wake of extreme physical or emotional stress.
Which leaves me with a final lingering thought to mull over.
Okay.
If our brains literally manufacture molecules named after bliss out of their own cellular membranes,
yeah,
synthesizing calm strictly on demand, in the exact millisecond of extreme stress or fear, what does that tell us about our baseline resilience? Maybe true balance isn't something we need to constantly ingest or seek out from the external world. Maybe it is literally woven into the structural fat of our minds, just waiting for the exact right moment to reach across the void and hit the dimmer switch.
Wow.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Keep questioning and keep exploring.